All right, Erev Tov, welcome back. It's been a long hiatus. This is the series Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, Part 18. And tonight we're discussing Rav Avram Yeshayahu Karelitz, the Chazon Ish. There are few people that have dominated Israeli life and even politics for more than a half century after their deaths, such as the Chazon Ish did. And what makes him even more remarkable is that for most of his life, he really held no formal rabbinic position. He was never the rav of a shul, a city, a town. He was not a rosh yeshiva. For the most part, he never even learned in yeshiva during his formative years, never really had a job for that matter, and yet his influence was and is substantial. So he left his mark on Israeli society, as we'll discuss, and especially the Haredi world. And to a great extent, decisions that he made, for example, on service in the IDF for yeshiva students and Sheirut Lumi, Shemitah observance, etc., continued to reverberate in Israel, have to some degree inhibited the full integration of the Haredi community into Israeli society. And no doubt that was part of his intent. In a famous meeting, we'll get to it later, David Ben-Gurion sought his guidance or agreement on certain pressing issues of the day. And even though the Chazon Ish held no formal position, what he did have was the universal respect of the Torah world for his genius, his erudition, his hasmoda in Torah, his midos tovos, and especially his love of Klal Yisrael. Thus, I don't doubt that he exercises greater influence in Israeli life today, notwithstanding that he died in 1953, than does, for example, David Ben-Gurion. And the coalition demands of the Haredi parties, to an enormous extent, still follow the guidelines and shitos of the Chazon Ish. And he's famous in the Torah world for his shiurim, the precise weights and measures for the performance of mitzvahs, kezayis, revias, asa'ah, etc., that are one of the three basic opinions followed by Jews. A wag suggested that the lecture tonight has to be longer than the other ones because the Chazon Ish shiurim are always larger than the other shiurim. So it probably will be. So how did he achieve this prominence? How did he have this enduring influence on Jewish life? And especially when we consider the Chazon Ish, like several other great rabbis in our series, did not merit having children of his own. So how did he become the Chazon Ish and that great hashpa until today? Rav Avram Yeshayahu Karelitz was born in November 1878, the 11th of Mar Cheshvan. In fact, his birthday was just on Shabbos, in the town of Kosovo, which is right between Minsk and Brisk, almost halfway in between, Kosovo being one of the Karpas cities that had no Hasidim. Kosovo, Ruzhinai, Pruzhina, and Slutsk. They had no Hasidim. So he was born to his parents, Rav Shmariel Yosef and Rashalea Karelitz. He was the Rav of Kosovo. He succeeded his own father-in-law in 1882. And he was known as a Gaon and a Tzaddik, as his mother was renowned for her piety and her kindness. And all this could be expected. He was the second of nine children. And less expected was that he never went to yeshiva. And yet, his three brothers all became rabbis. His five sisters all married rabbis. Some of them are very well known to us. One sister married Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the Stipler Gaon, was the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, making Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky Shlita his nephew. Another sister married Rabbi Nochum Karelitz, same last name, different family. Her son, Rabbi Nissen Karelitz, just died over Sukkos. He was one of the leaders, the Kol Chazon Ish, etc. It was a very high-powered Torah family. In fact, just to show you the connections that exist that are unexpected, his mother's sister was the mother of Professor Shaul Lieberman, making him and the Chazon Ish first cousins. And they had a relationship really until the early 1940s. The Chazon Ish was precocious. At age 3, he told his father that he knows all of Shas. Asked how that could be, so he answered that he knows all the letters of the Aleph Beis. So there's not one letter in all of Shas that he can't read. His father hired as a tutor an older man who had been a Talmud of Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhin, Reb Chaim's son. So Chazon Ish grew up steeped in the wisdom and derech of the Gaon Mivilna. At age 10, he had outgrown his tutor, and his father became his primary teacher. So he never attended a formal yeshiva. At his bar mitzvah, this is his older brother said at his levaya, at his bar mitzvah he announced that he wanted to dedicate his entire life to Torah lishma, just learning Torah for its own sake. So he didn't necessarily learn alone, that's not always a successful methodology in one's formative years, but he learned b'chavrusa, so he had companions his own age, but he spent his days entirely engrossed in Talmud Torah. And this took a toll on his health, which was always fragile. He was always frail. At age 14, he traveled to Brisk to make the acquaintance of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, but soon he had to leave because of ill health. But he maintained a correspondence with Reb Chaim, sending him questions and chidushim, and he began publishing articles as a teenager in Torah journals under the name Ish Mikosova. Ish being a contraction of his name, Avram Yeshayahu Ish. That became his moniker. In fact, he would sign all his letters, Ish, Aleph Yud Shin. For years, he published anonymously, not seeking any acclaim at all part of Torah Lishma. But it's hard to remain anonymous in the Torah world. You know, there's one such Talmud Chacham in Israel today who publishes amazing Sfarim, is a tremendous Talmud Chacham, whose identity people are still trying to figure out. His Torah thoughts came to the attention of Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, the legendary Av Beis in Vilna. The Chazon Ish had revealed his hometown, Ish Mikosova, and soon Reb Chaim Moshe figured out who it was, and he sent for him. He made his first trip to Vilna in 1905, age 26, and for a very brief time. And the only time he was in any formal structure, he learned what Reb Chaim Moshe called the kibbutz of Reb Chaim. He had Talmidim there. We encountered Gedolim, one Reb Yitzchak Blaser, soon to make Aliyah. But he did not last long in the kibbutz, and he soon returned to learning on his own. Did he study anything else? Well, in the life of the Chazon Ish, it's hard to separate fact from hagiographic fiction. Only book that really perceives him as a real human being is a biography written by a professor, Benjamin Brown, as professor at Hebrew University. And he asserts, among other things, that it's clear from the Chazon Ish's writings that he read Haskalah literature as a youth because he was well-read. And, sort of rare among his contemporaries, he wrote in perfect Hebrew. And perfect Hebrew without the introduction of any Yiddish words. And in many so-called secular areas, he was an autodidact. He was self-taught in many of the sciences as well. If you have to look at the Chazon Ish's life, I think, as he would want us to look at it. If you look at the reader, number one, it's in the second volume of his Kovetz Igros, his collected writings. He said, inter alia, that Roi lamachazikim mitaras Hashem, ladas es gedoleha ba'ofiyam amiti. It's appropriate for people who grasp God's Torah to know its great ones, its gedolim, in their true character. And he says, even to the extent that if it's permissible to talk Lashon Hara about a craftsman to prevent people from using him and suffering, so al mi shetarasa umanasa lo kol shekein, certainly people who make Torah their livelihood, mutar lahodiya l'machazikim mitorah tzrichim ladas, you have to let them know everything about a particular gadol. Ki hayidia shachachmei hador liba mumidosam hein hein gufei Torah. Knowing about the chachamim, their hearts, their minds, their character, that itself is gufei Torah. That's part of what we need to learn. He says, nonetheless, We have to have a zehirut yetera, a special care, lest we say something that's even slightly incorrect. V'nimtza motzi shemro al talmid chacham, and we come out and we have besmirched falsely a talmid chacham. But nonetheless, he would admire truth, his powers in learning, in concentration, in depth of study, were extraordinary. He was not a gregarious person in any sense, and he always suffered from a weak heart, and so his desirability as a chassan was somewhat limited. He was even more limited because he was already known as a young man as a great machmir in halacha. Meaning, I say without exaggeration, certainly without any criticism, he embraced every chumrah. Wherever there was a chumrah, he, in his personal life, he embraced it. Secondly, he was not interested in serving the rabbanos. All he wanted to do was learn. In 1906, he married Basia, the daughter of Reb Mordechai Bey, who's a businessman and Talmud Chacham from Kvaidan in western Lithuania. But that too was not without some controversy. So it was agreed during the engagement that she would support him. He would learn full time. He was not expected to get a job as a Rav or Rosh Yeshiva anywhere. And she agreed happily. But apparently there was some discrepancy about her age. She was much older than he was, and how old she was became an issue. And it turned out that she indeed was much older, maybe as much as 18 years older than he was. He was 27, that would make her 45, and his parents wanted him to break off the shidduch, and the Chazon Ish refused, so as not to embarrass a Jewish woman. So they married, and she always upheld her end of the agreement, running a textile shop wherever they lived, and supporting him in his learning. And he learned b'chavrusa during this time with Rav Moshe Rosen, who was the Rav of Kvaidan, the author of the Nezer Kodesh, later became a Rav in Brooklyn. They were very close, and these were happy years. By 1911, he'd published his first sefer, and he called it, like everything else that followed, Chazon Ish, the vision of the Ish, Avraham Yeshaya. Again, but that is full name in the cover page, on Arachayim, parts of the Aradea, and it was anonymous. Rechaim Briska saw a copy of it, perused it, and he said, there's no reason to remain anonymous. It's nothing to be ashamed of. He should own up to it. Life, though, was not entirely blissful. So she, Basha's wife, was very dedicated to him, and his main contribution was occasionally helping out with the bookkeeping in the store. When World War I broke out in 1914, the Chazon Ish and his wife fled Kvaidan, which was near the Russian-Germany border, and they moved to Stoyevitz, which is more inland. In Stoyevitz, he later noted that he wrote a complicated perush to Meseches Kalim, the Chazon Ish on Meseches Kalim, amid the bombings. The bombs were falling, and he's learning and writing. And in Stoyevitz, he was persuaded by the Rav, Raviol Sarotskin, the brother of Zalman Sarotskin, to assist him. And that would really be his only quasi-job his entire life. It was just for a couple of years. He began to give shiurim to some groups in Stoyevitz, including Talmidim of Mir, who'd been exiled there. In 1917, he moved to Minsk, while she stayed in Stoyevitz running the business, and just joined him for Shabbos. In each place, he attracted the attention of the local rabbis. But his cousin, Shaul Lieberman, later wrote that these were blissful years for him. He just learned. He was known where he lived, but he was not famous beyond that. And he subsisted on small stipends that were sent to him by his wife. Rumors are his learning was so intense that he only went to Minyan on Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos to Kriyas HaTorah. Otherwise, he just learned. In Minsk, it was Rabiel's brother, Zalman, who arranged for a deferment from military service for the Russian army. Rabbanim were exempt. But it's not even known who gave the Chazon Ish smicha, strange as that sounds, because he just did his own learning. He was pure Torah through and through. Among the byproducts of this, he opposed the Musar movement as a distraction from Talmud Torah. And yet, as the story goes, in Minsk, he went to hear a Musar shmuz from the Alta of Slobodka, who was visiting. And when the Alta realized who he was and questioned why he, the Chazon Ish, an opponent of Musa, was there, So the Chazon Ish responded that indeed I am an opponent of Mussar, but I'm even more opposed to opponents of Mussar. And so he came. In general, he opposed the Mussar movement because he did not believe in emphasizing shortcomings in a person's life, but rather prioritizing Torah and Midos and Mitzvos, and the shortcomings will take care of themselves. In 1917, it's a hard world to understand for us in modern times, the Chazon Ish's father died in Kosovo, but because of the war, he didn't learn about it for 4 months. I think he died in Iyar, and he found out just a few days before Rosh Hashanah that his father died. In 1920, the Chazon Ish and his wife fled communism. It was after the Bolshevik Revolution. And they moved to Vilna, then part of independent Poland. And there she opened up a textile shop in the two-room apartment that his brother had rented for them, but problems arose. It became clear over the years that the couple's childlessness was due, maybe in large part, to the advanced age of his wife, Basia, when they married. Several times he offered to give her a get so he could marry and have children, and she refused. In Vilna, as the story goes, they spoke about it walking one day. They were crossing a bridge. He asked her again, and she said that she'd accept a get, but on return from the Beistin, she would jump off this very bridge. And he relented, and he never raised the issue again. His brother-in-law, Shmuel Greineman, rented a room for him in a Vilna suburb, a bed, a chair, a desk, and svarim, and it seems that they lived apart for a couple of years, at least 3 years. He just learned, but she supports, she brought him food, in fact. And then later on, their marriage was, I'll say, back on track, but they lived under the same roof again. We shouldn't get the wrong impression of this giant, nor should we mere mortals judge him. I mean, the fact is, when he married, you have to think of the Mesiris Nefesh of Yaakov Avinu, who didn't call off the marriage, he didn't go to Beistin for Mikachtos when Vihinehi Leo. See, Chazon Ish knew what he was doing, but the love and concern that he had for any Bas Yisrael, not to mention this one and the woman now his wife, was such that he found it very hard to break up and didn't. See, he wasn't a garrulous person by any sense, but he was apparently very warm and open and kind and generous with his time. In Kvaidan, for example, during the war, World War I, there was once an outbreak of a plague. Many Jews died, and the Chevra Kadisha refused to bury the dead for fear of contracting illness. So Chazon Ish buried body after body by himself. Even in Kvaidan, people would consult him frequently, but this problem with his wife and children proved insoluble, and he wrote svarim. And in a real sense, the svarim became his offspring. For a time in Vilna, well over a decade, he had a guest in his home named Chaim Grada, famous author, with whom he learned Bechavrusa for 7 years, and he also taught young students. He surrounded himself with children. He did become involved in several controversies in Vilna, each of which helps us to understand his worldview. So he greatly opposed the appointment of Rav Yitzhak Rubinstein as the chief rabbi of Vilna. So that was a government appointment for reasons we discussed in our great controversy series. But nonetheless, it was seen as a slight to Reb Chaim Ozer. So Reb Yitzhak Rubinstein was a Talmud Chacham as well, but his primary flaw in the eyes of Chazon Ish was that he was a Mizrachist. He was a religious Zionist, and religious Zionism was anathema to the Chazon Ish. So Reb Rubinstein was very deferential to Reb Chaim Ozer, but he was never fully accepted. Funny how life is. That eventually saved his life, because he was not accepted fully as the Rav of Vilna. He left before 1939, and so he was spared the Holocaust, and he taught. He wound up teaching, giving shiur at YU for a number of years before he died. I think it was 1945. The second controversy, almost similar grounds or the different case, involved a written attack on Chidushim that was published by young Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, who was then a student at Humboldt University in Berlin. So apparently the attack was motivated by an attempt to discredit the Rav and his father, Rav Moshe, who was then teaching at Reeds, because Rav Moshe Soloveitchik had also become a Mizrachist at the time. And the Chazon Ish and others felt it would be dangerous if the religious Zionist movement became identified in the public mind with a great Talmud Chacham. It's much harder to discredit if some of the notables in the movement are tremendous Talmud Chachamim. So he wrote an attack on the Rav's Torah, claiming it was really Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's Torah, but then he was in America, and nonetheless it turned out it was the Rav's Torah, and that was the dialogue. However we look at it, you see two things. The Chazon Ish was dominated by two ideological cornerstones his entire life, and that would shape his life in Israel as well. One was the beauty of Torah Lishma. That's it, as the essence of Jewish life. And the second was opposition to Zionism, especially religious Zionism. It remains fascinating that in Vilna, too, he rejected any formal rabbinic position. Reb Chaim Ozer offered him to be on the Beis Din. One job, nothing. He refused everything. Reb Chaim would send him shilas to deal with, but he declined any public role. He just learned. His wife, and he published. His wife had her textile shop, and he wrote Svarim, and they subsisted, and money meant nothing to them. Once a fire broke out in his apartment building, and he rushed into the fire to save his manuscripts of the Chazon Ish that he'd written that were not yet published. Everything else was lost, but nothing else mattered. In Vilna, too, in the late 1920s, he became close to the Chafetz Chaim, who was an Aradan, of course, so close that he quoted him regularly in the Chazon Ish. In fact, so close that one of the popular editions of the Mishnah Berurah, I have one at home, in fact, has an appendix with the psukim of the Chazon Ish in the Svarim itself. So he was cherished in Vilna as a gadol, but he was still not widely known to the general public. And it's the early 1930s, and the Chazon Ish is already in his mid-50s, and then word came from Israel that the old Yishuv was looking for a Sgan, an assistant, and then a successor to the venerable Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, and they wanted the Chazon Ish. And they appealed to Chaim Ozer, who went to see the Chazon Ish, and again he declined. He did not want that position either, but events would drive him to the land of Israel anyway, even without a formal rabbinic role, and arguably because he lacked a formal rabbinic role, he became even more influential. So the impetus for Aliyah was, of course, spiritual. The Chazon Ish held there's a mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel today, even according to the Rambam, not just according to the Ramban, but the immediate cause, the proximate cause, was unfortunately a burglary of his wife's business that cleaned it out. And they were left with nothing. So they moved out of Vilna a few months later. It was the summer of 1933. Very few possessions, without even knowing where they would live. Reb Chaim Ozer arranged that a delegation from Agudat Yisrael would meet them at the port of Yafo. And the Chazon Ish and his wife first stayed at a Rav's home in Tel Aviv. And they finally rented an apartment in Tel Aviv on Rehov Geula. As his wife could not successfully reopen her business in Israel, they decided that they would be supported from the sales of his Svarim and nothing else. From that day on, really as soon as he came to Israel, he began immersing himself in the mitzvos hatulyos ba'aretz. He became a tremendous baki in the laws of Shemitah and Kilayim and Arla and Trumas and Maestros and the like. And he publicized his Chidushim as well. In all, he wrote 23 Svarim, comprehensive discussions of all four sections of Shulchan Aruch, and many, many Masechtos as well. And in these eponymous Svarim, Chazon Ish, he would take a topic and examine it exhaustively. It's not light reading. He was not given over excessively to the Lithuanian style of learning. Everything was natural to him, he wrote. HaPashtut hi tamid emet. Pashtus, the simple pshat, always guides us to the truth. and his derech was to completely understand the opinions of the Rishonim and then clarify the halacha. From his perspective, you could not even budge unless you knew the Gemara clearly and the Rishonim clearly, and it was not learning until you came to halacha brura. Analogous, by the way, to Rav Kook's approach as well. Just to give you some samples, so it's not all talk, if you take out your reader, I just chose two, somewhat at random. The first is not, number six, it's from Yishim V'Shitot of Rav Zevin. So the case here, it's a machlokas in the Gemara Baba Kama. According to the Chachamim, Stam Gneva Yeush Bailam Hu Stam Gzela Ein Bo Yeush. If a person is burglarized, Gneva, the Chachamim say, the owner right away despairs of recovering his property and forfeits his ownership over it, but Stam Gzela, Gzela is a robbery, burglary is a home invasion, Gzela is a robbery, person to person, there's no Yeush. Reb Shimon in the Gemara Kiddush is exactly opposite. That there's Yeush for Gzela, but not Yeush for Gneva. And he notes, Reb Zevin does, that generally people approach this Gemara in terms of who, from whom will you have more despair? From a Ganav or from a Gazlan? And the Chazanish disagreed, because he said, it's in Kalim, in Cain, then you're just arguing over the Metzius with different arguments. A robber is worse. A burglar is worse. There's nothing to pin it on. So he said that's not the pshat. He said the pshat is, it's five lines from the bottom, in Yono, d'chol yeish psichi bo ma'atikva, uv'chol tikva psichi bo yeish. Every yeish, every despair, has a little hope in it also. And every hope has a little despair. And that's the machlokas here. According to the Chachamim, there's greater yeush when you're dealing with a ganav. There's more despair because you don't know who stole from you. By definition, a burglar comes in stealth, so you have no address from who you can claim your property. Ein lo makom yadu l'tikvato. There's no known place we can place his hope to recover his property. Yeush is greater. According to Reb Shimon, it's the opposite. Yeush is greater when you're dealing with a gazlan, a robber, because mitzad rifyon kocho, you feel weak. He took it from you. You were vulnerable, defenseless. So the question is, what creates the greater sense of yeush, notwithstanding his always hope of recovery? Is it an inability to know where your property is? Or is it an inability to recover your property because of the violence of the perpetrator? That's how we understood it. To take another one in number seven, this really was random. It's an Archaim Siman Zion. So we have a din of Shomea Ka'ona, that you listen to someone's bracha, have in mind to fulfill that bracha. Someone makes kiddush, you say amen, you could drink also. All right? Benches for that matter, he lists every word, Shomea Ka'ona. But the question he asks is, how does Shomea Ka'ona operate? Cheyotze b'masa shmia l'chud, just that you hear it? Meaning, you're passively hearing the brach of another, and you're yotze by answering, by listening and answering, or it's that mityaches elov gama dibur shalama shmia aide shmia. V'yotze chavoso b'shituf, or we say, no, it's not the passive listening, but rather it's a partnership, that when the person is saying the bracha, it's as if you're saying it also. You're not just listening, but you too. His dibur is your dibur, and your shmia becomes his as well. And he goes on to explain, in his opinion, it's really the second one, that it's a shituf, it's a partnership, it's not just one. Anyway, multiply these by the thousands, without exaggeration, and you get an insight into the scope of the Sifrei Chazon Ish and all those volumes. HaPashtut hi tamid emet. You have to know the simple pshat. Pashtus doesn't mean simplistic. On the contrary, his analyses were very thorough and very deep. Posthumously, his family, his brothers-in-law, published another sefer, a very thin volume, called Emunah U'Bitachon, in which he discussed with great insight and sophistication the essence and objectives of human life. So he distinguished between Emunah and Bitachon. People often use the words interchangeably, but they really mean two different things. Emunah is a corpus of ideas. Bitachon is how those ideas affect the person in real time. And then it's on something else, a famous passage, maybe the most famous, defining bitachon in a way that demystifies it. So if you look at number two, back on the first, I'm sorry, number four, on the first page, the beginning of Perek Beis, he says, Tot noshenet, there's an old mistake people make about the musag bitachon. He said that for many people, bitachon means, in the sub musag, chovel amin, an obligation to believe this, that bechol mikre shepogesh adam v'amidato likrat atid bilti mukhra u'shnei darchim be'atid achat tava v'lo shniya. Any situation a person encounters, and he has in the future two different paths, one good, one not so good. So bitachon, people think, is ki betach yatov, that the good will definitely happen, v'mistapek v'choshesh achlipuch atov, hu michos bitachon. And if you think there's a chance that the bad might happen, then you're lacking bitachon. He said that is, a lot of people believe that. That is wrong. Ein harozo b'bitachon nechona, just incorrect. What's bitachon? Because it has to be incorrect, because unless we have nevuah, prophecy, nobody knows what the future holds. Aval, second from the last at the bottom. Inan bitachon hu ha'emun she'ein mikre ba'olam. Bitachon means essentially the belief that there's nothing that happens in the world that happens by chance. V'chol ha'nasa tachat ha'shemesh ha'kol b'ha'charza meito yitbarach. Everything that happens under the sun, it's because God wants it to happen. What's bitachon then? It's a surrender to the Yad Hashem. Bitachon means a person's confronted with a situation, doesn't know what's going to be, the things he has to do as well. Bitachon means I'm confident, the Ratzon Hashem will prevail, and I submit myself to the Ratzon Hashem. He wrote numerous letters from which you also derive his Hashkafa. I quoted one in number three here. It's in Pei Tes, in the second Chelek. Dichut ruach shel adam kasha yoter midocha she'atzrachim agufaniyim. He said, depression is worse than physical poverty or deprivation. Depression is worse. The context doesn't matter. But he says people were apparently asking too much of his time, and he said he can't turn them away. But you have to know, he quotes the Shari Tshuva at the end, that's also considered losir debo befarech, not being oppressive to another person, demanding more and more of them. So he says things come to him, and they're depressing, and depression is worse, also much harder to resolve than is penury. Very interestingly, he came to Israel in 1933. He had almost an aversion to living in and even visiting Yerushalayim. It was several years, I think it was 1938 or 37, before he went to Yerushalayim for the first time. But he had determined not to live among tzaddikim, but rather some new yeshuv where he could help plant the seeds of Torah. And that's how he came to Bnei Brak, just a few months after his arrival. We think Bnei Brak existed, you know, back in Rebbe Akiva's time. It did, but there was an interval. Modern Bnei Brak was only founded in 1924, just 9 years before the Chazon Ish showed up. When he came there, it was a backwater, so primitive that in his apartment, which was a hovel, he didn't have running water. A few months later, already his reputation was getting out there, a wealthy person from Chicago offered to build a home for the Chazon Ish, and he refused. So the man built a building anyway, and the Chazon Ish relented, and he said, I'll just accept this, a bedroom, a kitchen, and a study, and a Beis Medrash, where he would daven. And that is where the Chazon Ish davened almost the rest of his life. Sometimes, truth be told, you know, they had to grab in people off the streets to make a minyan for Mincha Ma'ariv. But nonetheless, That's where he lived, learned, davened. He insisted on paying the property taxes and the maintenance, and that building still exists. I think it's a little school for little children now. And with it all, he steadfastly declined any official position or role, unlike several of his brothers or brothers-in-law, who became famous rabbanim and communal leaders. The one public role he assumed was when he established something that exists until today. In 1936, he founded the Kollel Avreichim in Bnei Brak, which soon came to be known after his death as the Kollel Chazon Ish, and that has molded numerous Talmidei Chachamim over the decades. So the first major controversy in which the Chazon Ish became involved, aside from the Hetam Mechir for Shemitah, which many others also differed with Rav Kook, was the famous international dateline controversy of 1941 involving the Mir Yeshiva students and other Jews who had escaped from Lithuania and found themselves in Kobe, Japan. And they sent a letter to the chief rabbi, to Rav Herzog, to Rav Tukachinsky, and others, including the Chazon Ish, as to when they should observe Shabbos, and especially Yom HaKippurim. So there are four or five different opinions on the topic. Generally, briefly, we don't measure days from Greenwich, but Yerushalayim is the center of the world. 90 degrees east of Yerushalayim is the date line, according to the Chazon Ish, based on the Kuzari and others as well. So according to this, 90 degrees of Yerushalayim was slightly west of Japan. Kobe was 100 degrees west of Yerushalayim. So as opposed to Rav Herzog, Rav Uziel, Rav Tukachinsky, who ruled they should observe Shabbos on the same day the Jewish community observed Shabbos, the Chazon Ish ruled they should observe Shabbos on Japan Sunday. The practical consequences, of course, were that those who heeded the Chazon Ish, and of course, there always is an interest in the novel opinion that makes you stand out from everyone else, the Jews of Kobe, a community there, they're observing Shabbos on Shabbos, and the others are Mechalei Shabbos, and they're holding Shabbos on Sunday. Yom Kippur was also a different day. Thursday that year instead of Wednesday. He published a whole pamphlet on it. He'd done the research years earlier. If you look at number two, the letter that came out just in the middle of the controversy, he says, "Im ki kashel ali kanes baril rabim l'masa." Even though it's difficult for me to enter into practical halachic guidance, practical. As is my custom, I will just write in terms of learning. He says, I can't remain silent. And he goes into why the Kuzri is correct, the others are wrong, the Gedolim are wrong, the others are wrong also. And then he says in the last paragraph, four lines from the bottom, the afim divrayim zal kashim be'einenu behleit, even though the opinion is difficult to follow. Onurgilim lachof roshenu tachat kapod raglayim, we're still accustomed to bowing our heads before the soles of their feet. Ki kol kushyot yesh lo terutz, every question has an answer. So it's difficult for them to follow the psak, because everyone has Shabbos one day and they a different day, so be it, he didn't care. Well, this caused such an upheaval in the community that they basically were told to leave. And that's how they wound up in Shanghai, which is on the other side of the dateline, and did not have to deal with these issues anymore. The fact that they would heed the opinion of the Chazon Ish, again, who held no formal position, over the more establishment rabbis, testified to the esteem in which the Chazon Ish was held, and that his piskei halacha were pure, and without consideration of any other factors, it was the autonomy of the untethered. And this is both a virtue and a vice, as I've noted a number of times. Chacham Ovadia once commented about the Chazon Ish, "Imein lecha tafkid, ata mishuchrar." If you have no job, so you're liberated. "Ein lecha bayot," you have no problems. "L'chaim b'chol davar, ata mechapes chumrot." In everything, you just look for chumros. Yoshev v'toch yarketei beitecha v'kotev masha kotev. You could sit within the four walls of your home and just write what you write. It's true. On the other hand, the Chazon Ish had what Rav Zevin called koach hachlata, the power to decide. If he wasn't ambivalent. If he thought he was right, it didn't matter to him who or how many opposed him. And people could decide to do what they wanted to do. And of course he set a standard for rigid adherence to halacha, things that still exist. After learning that Jewish workers were staffing the Bnei Brak power station on Shabbos in case of emergency, he began using his own generator and encouraged others to do the same. So it's a good example of a chumrah. Mikra din, Jewish workers could work because there's an element of pikuach nefesh involved. If power goes out, it's not just in my home, but it's in the hospitals as well, and all the attendant consequences. On the other hand, you can hire non-Jews, Arabs, to do the work. On the third hand, you can't always trust them. On the fourth hand, this is not Europe. It's a Jewish state. And you can't rely on Shabbos Goyim for electricity, army, police, etc. You have to want to be a nation, you have to take responsibility. On the fourth hand, if you don't feel there's such a value, or the fifth hand, if you don't feel such a value in having a Jewish state, then you insist, or you get your own generator, which he did, and which I think Ad Hayom and Bnei Brak, there are many people who still use their own generators on Shabbos. He held that using electricity, flicking a switch, was an isdaraisa of bona. Now, there are many different opinions as well. It was unique. It's a good lumdish opinion. What's bona? Putting two things together. So closing a circuit that generates current is putting two entities together. You can discern a difference, but considering this a Torah prohibition, raise the stakes. A young Reb Shlomo Zalman disagreed. Wrote a whole sefer called Ma'ari Ha'esh. But others held Darais as well. The Chazon Ish's opinion is the most stringent. He held you had to say Tfilas HaDerech whenever you left Bnei Brak, even to go to Petach Tikva, which is the other side of the highway. The Chazon Ish didn't wear a watch because he held that wearing a watch for a man violated the Isser of Lo Yilbash Gever Simlas Isha. It was women's wear. How? That is unclear. When Chaim Kanievsky was asked about it, if it's true, he said it is true. See, he was asked, how can it be Rav El Yoshev wears a watch? Rav Chaim answered that he also used to wear a watch. But when he heard the objection of the Chazon Ish, he stopped. Because if the Chazon Ish objected, Ro'i Lahachmir. He stood for Kedusha in Uvalotzion, Kedusha de Sidra, saying, Ezitichnit, I just can't sit. You're saying, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. How is it possible to sit? And most famous, I mentioned at the beginning, he had exacting large standards when it came to halachic measurements, shiurim, directly taking on Rav Avram Chaim Noah, who was a Svardi, a Lubavitcher also, but involved in Eda Charedis. How large? The Chazon Ish's Kezias is almost twice as large as that of Reb Chaim Avram Noah. That's why we wind up with a matzah on Leil Pesach the size of the paroches, because based on that, his revius for a cup of Kiddush was 5.2 ounces. Reb Chaim Noah, I think, is 3.3. Reb Moshe is 4.2 or thereabouts. His mill was longer. And he didn't make it up. Hishum relied on Notabi Yehuda, who rule that olives today, our olives, are smaller than the olives in the time of the Gemara. And to this, the Chazon Ish added that Shnei Alofim Torah, the 2,000 years of Torah of which Chazal spoke, means Shum finalized then. If a Kezias then was the size of an apple or a watermelon, that's what we live with. Now you can argue all these points, or Moshe Feinstein certainly disagreed, but it's easy to see how such stringencies can become mainstream. And they do create a situation where people use them to gain virtue on the cheap, as if this type of piety suits those that are not on the level of the Chazon Ish. And that's the danger. It's not his fault, but the notion, you know, people being makpid on shiurim and Shabbos and kashrus, and also lying and stealing is not unknown to us, because the latter is difficult. The former really is not. So Chazon Ish is completely sincere. I fear that not everyone who embraces every single chumrah of the Chazon Ish is likewise. But he was also known, even by people who know little else about him, for lenient opinion that's cited regularly, declaring in essence there's no such thing anymore as an apikoros. This is one of the most famous passages in the Chazon Ish. We have it here, number 5 on the left side. It's Yoredei Siman Beis, Sifkat and Tezayin, that you ordinarily with an apikoros, we'd say Morida Vilomailim, we can throw them into a pit. And if they're there, we don't lift them up, we let them die. He said, all that applies, Rak Ela Bizman Shashgachaso Yisbach Gluya, Kemo Bizman Shayunisim Mitsuyin, Umishamesh Baskal. That only applied when God's providence was revealed and obvious in the miracles. Vitzadiki Hador Tachas Hashgacha Pratis Anir Slain Kol. And people, the non-observer, the non-believer, saw the special Hashgacha that pertained to the righteous people. So then, the Kofer in Oz, the heretics then, he benilizus miyuchados ba'atoyas hayetz l'tavos hefkeros. Then the heretics had a special perversion, a brazenness about them in their lust for physical desire. And so they're in the category of Rasham who had to be eliminated. Avo bizman ha-helem, when God is not always visible, hidden from us. Shenichrisa emuna min dalas am, and the simple faith is really cut off from the Hamon. Ein b'masa harada geder apiritza ela hosofas apiritza. Then to throw them into a bar, meaning to get rid of them, that doesn't put a fence around the breach, that expands the breach, because it would be considered by them an act of destruction and violence, chas v'shalom. So what do we have to do today in such a time? We have to bring them back with cords of love, and to lift them up with pride as much as we can. This, say another way, is the famous notion that we hear all the time of those who are not raised with Torah being tinoko shenishbu. They're like infants captured, raised amongst the nations who don't know any better. Now, the truth is, whether you could say such a thing categorically is arguable, but such was the sway of the Chazon Ish that few challenge this opinion, which enables Jews to relate to each other as one nation. Maybe most importantly, his home became the go-to address for people who sought his advice and guidance on any matter. And for 15 years, if not a little longer, there was a steady stream of visitors to his home every day. Even lines outside his home, young and old, men and women. The Ponovitcherov said that before he came to Israel, he didn't do anything without consulting the Chafetz Chaim. And when he came to Israel, he always consulted the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish became proficient in engineering and medicine. Aside from the mystical stories, he would guide physicians and patients to treatments based on his knowledge. Many of these visitors became the source of so many Chazon Ish references and rulings. The Chazon Ish did this, he said that. Reb Chaim Kanievsky's nephew once noted the unreliability of these first-hand accounts, because, he said, my uncle said various things to various people. He didn't always give the same answer to everyone. So now we get to maybe the biggest and most enduring controversy. You know, you can't avoid politics in the land of Israel. So the relation with Chazon Ish and Rav Kook, for example, is one that's denied by Charedim and acknowledged by history. They met soon after the Chazon Ish arrived. And it makes sense, because the two greatest influences on the Chazon Ish in Vilna, Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski and the Chafetz Chaim, had enormous respect for Rav Kook. And indeed, the Chazon Ish had sent two questions to Rav Kook from Europe, to prepare himself for the meticulous observance of the mitzvos hatliyos baretz. So he didn't agree on the het mechira. That's not unique to the Chazon Ish. And since their lives only overlap by 2 years, Rav Kook died in 1935, the Chazon Ish never actually observed the Shemitah year in Israel during Rav Kook's lifetime. But he published his commentary on Maseches Shviyos right before the Shemitah of 1938, vehemently opposing the Heter, which now caused problems because already his sway was growing. He was appealed to by several religious kibbutzim, and he ruled that they can do certain things, weeding, for example, to prevent long-term harm. And the Chazon Ish also created the network of Otzer Beis Din to market permissible Shemitah produce. All of this still exists. Now, obviously, the Chazon Ish Rav Kook did not share the same view of Jewish nationalism, but the Chazon Ish had remembered Rav Kook from Europe, where he too was known for his hasmada. When a student in Ponovich told the Chazon Ish that he learns Rav Kook's Sifrei Machshava, the Chazon Ish smiled and he praised Rav Kook's diligence in Shas and Poskim, which is a subtle hint that Talmud took. He was a great Rav. He should first learn the meat of Torah, like Rav Kook did, and then learn other areas. But when Rav Kook came to Bnei Brak in 1934 to lay the cornerstone of the Navarika Yeshiva Beis Yosef, where the Stipla Gaon was made Rashiva right when he came from Europe, he first stopped at the Chazon Ish's home. They went together to the ceremony, and the Chazon Ish stood the entire time Rav Kook spoke, out of respect. Rav Kook spoke a long time, and the Chazon Ish was always frail, and people urged him to sit, and he responded, "Der Torah steht. The Torah is speaking," meaning Rav Kook, "so how can I sit?" None of these stories you'll find, by the way, in the Haredi press. When Rav Kook fell terminally ill, the Chazon Ish was told, and his eyes welled up with tears. He sent a messenger he wanted to visit, and Rav Kook told him not to. He said, "You're one of the great shakdanim of the generation. V'nichas al bitla Torah shelo. Better just to daven for me in your own home." But this dimension of the Chazon Ish's life is glossed over by the polemicists. So how did he relate to Zionism? Well, it's complicated. For the most part, it's negative. And these implications, too, are felt until today. So he insisted that we're not living through Atchalta de Geula, the beginning of the redemption, but rather what he called Sof HaGalut, the end of the exile. Asked, he said that anyone who celebrates Yom HaTzmut, he called them a frumer apikaris. All right, he meant religious Zionists. I mean apikaris because they're saying things that are not there, but they're doing it with a veneer of frumkeit. He was of the mindset, not atypical of his generation, and the European gedolim, like the Chafetz Chaim and many others, who saw no value in a Jewish state that was not based on Torah. It was not only anathema, it was actually an impossibility. Im Hashem lo bona bayis, shav amlu bona bo. It's not going to work. But then the Holocaust intervened, and that changed a lot of minds. It didn't change the Chazon Ish's mind. He did not waver in his views, even after the Holocaust, retaining the belief that Torah would protect. Well, Torah does protect, but we also live in the real world, which involves milchama, and enemies, and Nazis, and Jew-haters, and terrorists. And just like the Torah does not provide sustenance to people who refuse to eat and drink, and the Torah does not provide healing to those who shun medicine, so too does not provide protection to those who don't protect themselves. It's a strained argument that self-defense is the only area of life in which we become mystics. So he didn't deny the legitimacy of the state like the Satmar Rebbe did. When they met in 1952, the Satmar Rebbe thought that the Chazon Ish was insufficiently strident in his rejection of Zionism, but the Chazon Ish likened his dealings with the Israeli government to a person who was fighting off a bandit. And he said, "If I can save my life through talking to him, is that recognition? Is that legitimacy?" How negative were the relations? So this is not the Chazon Ish, but someone else. I think I know who it was. It's in my mind. I don't want to say it for sure. But another great Rav of the time once proclaimed to his followers that the Zionists were planning on a certain day and time, 1950s, to round up the entire Torah world and exterminate them en masse. They could have their secular state. When it didn't happen, he attributed it to divine intervention. Or maybe the whole thing was the product of a fevered imagination. But the Chazon Ish, and for that matter the Briska Rav, were almost the only two Gedolim who did not sign a proclamation in 1948 calling on all religious Jews to vote for the United Religious Front, only time Aguda and Mizrahi ran together. Now, to be sure, to be kind, Ben-Gurion did not inspire confidence in the Haredi world, and his vision of a purely secular state was quite sincere, if misguided. When he entered into the status quo agreement, June 19, 1947, Shabbos and Kashrus in all government institutions, control personal status, marriage, divorce, conversion by the Rabbanut, he did it because allegedly he did not think the Torah world would survive even another generation. Why would it? It would be swept away by modernity. See, he was wrong. So wrong that Israeli politics, especially the left, today vehemently objects to the continuation of the status quo. They never thought it would last this long. And that's a routine argument in every government, and that is not ending soon. Status quo agreement was not with the Chazon Ish. It was technically with Agudat Yisrael, but the Chazon Ish was deeply involved in the discussions. He was instrumental in winning from the government an exemption from military service of full-time yeshiva students, then numbering 400, and on the grounds of replenishing the supply of Tamei Chachamim after the devastation of the Holocaust. But of course, the number has grown exponentially into the tens of thousands. And we know as well that not all the exempt are Talmidei Chachamim, they're not all necessarily learning full-time, but this has become a perpetual source of tension in Israeli society. Some of it is contrived. There are many, many secular Israelis who gain exemptions from the IDF for the most frivolous of reasons. And some of it is real. You know, there's a basic unfairness involved in a religious Jew serving alone in some checkpoint on the night of the Seder while his Haredi peers, home with his family. Think about it. The broader issue involves whether the world represented by the Chazon Ish sees a value, saw a value in being part of the greater society, or is it content with isolating itself and only gaining funding for their parochial interests? As if to say, give us money for our schools, but we'll teach what we want to teach. Yesterday's Jerusalem Post headline, Israel under threat by lack of basic education for ultra-Orthodox. Give us money for our poor, who are untrained, unskilled, can't support themselves in large numbers. Give us money for our community, but we're not beholden to the rest of society for anything. The Chazon Ish carved out an isolationist path as the best guarantee for Torah, but he also created a template that is unsustainable, but which, because of his greatness and integrity, few have the courage to change. Some things did. For example, he championed the use of Yiddish in the Haredi school system, also as a means of sheltering the students from the greater world. They wouldn't speak the language. But it also leaves students woefully unprepared for life in Israel. And of course, those schools now are very, very few in number. And yet at the same time, he tried to guide others as well. And he had an openness about him that does not seem characteristic. When the Yeshivat Yeshuv Echadash in Tel Aviv consulted him about secular studies, he said they should. And they showed him the Netziv's letter opposing secular study in yeshiva. And he looked at the letter and he said, the Netziv's objections don't concern us. Indeed, he went on, each war has its own weapons. So was he monolithic in his answers? No. That's what Reb Chaim Kanievsky noted. Sometimes he gave different answers to different people. That aspect of his public life is not appreciated because followers largely choose the chumros and the most stringent anecdotes. He was one of the pioneers of the Chinuch Atzmi school system, independent of government control, but not always government money. And there, too, secular studies are taught. The extent of to which they're taught and the quality of the education, so that's debated even today. He fought against drafting yeshiva students, and he fought even more against Gius Banot, which was a cause celeb in his time, drafting girls into the army, in which he and others declared Yehareg Val Yavar. It wasn't hyperbole. He told his sister, Reb Chaim's wife, Miriam Kanievsky, she has to prepare to martyr her daughters in order to prevent their conscription. How different is our world today? There's so many religious girls think it's a mitzvah to serve in the army. Rav Aviner calls it a mitzvah baba vera. In the end, with the advocacy of Chief Rabbis Herzog and Uziel, religious girls were exempted from military service. But in the winter of 57-12, Ben-Gurion introduced legislation to have those exempt girls serve the country in a non-military capacity, Sherut Lumi, national service. And here too, the Chazanish declared, Yehoreg Val Yavar, based on the simple premise that girls must either be under the influence of their fathers or their husbands. That's it. The fear of other influences was too great. And apparently, the girls lack the strength of character to withstand the allures of the outside world. Ada Haredes unanimously condemned the amendment. Agudat Yisrael left the government over it for the next 60 years. No Aguda member served as a full minister in the cabinet. It was this opposition that led to this famous meeting of Ben-Gurion and the Chazon Ish. Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, to his credit, and with some opposition, came to the Chazon Ish's house in Bnei Brak. He didn't ask the Chazon to come to him. You should know, the Briskur Rav was first consulted, and he refused to meet Ben-Gurion. So he speaks well Ben-Gurion, he put the personal aside, that machlokes, he went to the home of a private citizen to appeal to him. Happened again by the two cases that I know of. When President Shazar, Shneur Zalman Shazar, came to America in the 60s, he went to visit Lubavitcher Rebbe in Crown Heights. Shazar, of course, being from a Chabad family, and the leftist press in Israel was apoplectic. How does the Nasi HaMedina humble himself to go to the to Rebbe? And Shazar said very simply, when I see Lubavitcher Rebbe, I'm a chassid. A chassid goes to the Rebbe. The Rebbe doesn't go to the chassid. Menachem Begin did the same thing, 1977, his first trip to America. He went to Crown Heights to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He went to Washington Heights to see Rav Soloveitchik. He went to the Lower East Side to see Rav Moshe Feinstein, saying he's a simple Jew, and a simple Jew pays his respects to great rabbis. He doesn't expect great rabbis to pay respects to him. This meeting, November 1952, Ben-Gurion wanted to discuss the Sherut Lumi bill, and his secretary, the future president, Yitzhak Navon, recorded, transcribed the conversation. I'll read it, just take 2 minutes, and we'll see this argument. It's played out for the next 68 years. Navon wrote, the Chazon Ish was short with shining wise eyes. He greeted Ben-Gurion pleasantly. Ben-Gurion began by saying, I've come to you to ask how we, religious and non-religious Jews, can live in the land without exploding from within. There are people with different hashkafas. How can we live together in this land? The Chazon Ish replied by quoting the Gemara I cited here in number 8 on the flip side, Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Beis, Amud Beis. V'chein shnei gemalim. You have two camels. There are malot Beit Choron, winding, narrow winding road up a mountain. One's going up a mountain, one's going down. They're both going up. Upagu zebozeh, they reached a ridge where only one camel could go. Imalush shnehem, if they both try to go, they'll both fall. Zachar zeh, one after the other, shnei molim. Who should go first? Hoketzad, teuna v'she'ena teuna. One bears a burden, the other does not bear a burden. Tidocha she'ena teuna b'bnei teuna. Let the one who's not bearing the burden give way to the one, make room for the one who is bearing the burden. the Chazan said, we, the Torah world, we're like the camel with a burden. We have a load of mitzvos incumbent upon us. We have the right of way. Ben-Gurion responded, he said, do you think this camel has no load? National security isn't a load in a mitzvah. Settling the land, absorbing immigrants, that's not a load. These are mitzvos. You should know, Agav Orcha, in the last 5-7 years, so whole literature has arisen in Israel based on this mashal of the Chazon Ish, that secular Judaism is not an Eina Teuna, but rather it has its own burden, its own load, its own value system, drawn from the prophets, but sounding a lot like Western liberalism and not very Jewish. But they no longer accept that only the religious have the burden. They have their own. Chazon Ish, in the schus of this, that we study Torah, you have the capability of doing what you do. Ben-Gurion, but those who sit on the borders who guard you, is this not a mitzvah? Chazon Ish, they survive in the schus that we study Torah. Ben-Gurion, but if these army bachim didn't get to you, the enemy would slaughter you. Chazon Ish, on the contrary, in the schus that we study Torah, they are capable of living, working, and holding guard. Ben-Gurion, I don't denigrate Torah, but if no people are alive, who will learn Torah? Chazon Ish, the Torah itself is Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, an elixir of life. Ben-Gurion, protecting lives is also mitzvah. Lo ha-mesim ya'aluka, the dead do not praise God. But I ask, how can we live here together? Chazon Ish, I see Chil Shabbos, cars, journeys on Shabbos. People travel to the sea instead of davening, learning Torah, living Jewish lives. This is provocative and shocks the soul to see such Chil Shabbos in the land of our forefathers. Ben-Gurion, one cannot force them to keep Shabbos. And if they don't go to the sea, you think they'll come to shul? Chazon Ish, I believe the day will come when everyone will observe Shabbos and Davin. Ben-Gurion, if they want, I will not oppose it. Let them do it, but it cannot be forced upon them. There cannot be religious coercion or anti-religious coercion. Each person should live as he sees fit. Navon ends, they gave up the discussion. He says, the argument went on, more or less repeating the two positions without drawing nearer to each other regarding substance. In the end, they rose, parted from each other in very friendly fashion with a handshake, and we went out. These arguments, exactly what you have until today. The meeting lasted all of 40 minutes. Worse, from the Chazanist perspective, unlike the army yeshiva issue, religious community here was divided. Mizrahi saw nothing wrong with public service, and this provoked a sharp and biting criticism from the Chazon Ish, accusing them of hatred of Torah and disrespect for Talmidei Chachamim. This we close, because his life soon ended. Notwithstanding the plea and the meeting and the mass tefillos that were held to avert the decree, the Knesset passed the Shirut Lumi law in Elul 1953, and the world did not collapse. So we wonder, in retrospect, about the true nature of the objection. Military service is one thing, but to serve in a public capacity, work in a school, a nursery, a soup kitchen, a nanny, in an office, do chesed. In retrospect, most religious girls do shirut lumi and survive quite well, and many benefit from the experience. It always seemed to me that the objection was essentially to the sovereignty of the state, as if the prime minister, whoever he might be, is perceived as the czar, but he also speaks Hebrew. That attitude still endures. Don't tell us what to do. Just be thankful we're here, or we'll go back to Europe. But it underscores the problem. The Torah world struggled, and still struggles, to come to grips with the reality of Jewish nationhood, the end of the Golos. Israel's not Minsk on the Mediterranean. And the shtick that was played with the Tsar are inappropriate in this context. What we do see is that the approach of the Chazon Ish has lingered until today and has only gotten stronger. Even modest efforts to enlist yeshiva students in the army have to be supported tacitly, just a few years ago, Steinman, who was over 100 already, he was physically attacked in his home for daring to implicitly suggest that those not learning should serve in the IDF. Chazanish held, and it's heartfelt, Iker Binyan Klal Yisrael is through building yeshivos. The essence of our survival is in yeshivos, large and small, and these are the mivtzarim, these are the fortresses of the Jewish people. Shortly after the Shir Lumi battle was lost, the Chazanish weakened. 2 months later, he died, age 75, on the 15th of Marcheshvan, in the year 5714, November 1953. Yartzeit is tomorrow night. You see the headline in number 9, Maran HaChazonish Einenu, with the beginning of the article about his funeral, Toch Hizdazut Nafshit, with the trembling of the soul, the news came to the Jewish world. He was buried in Bnei Brak. His wife outlived him by 5 years. So she died apparently in her late 90s. It was his greatness in Torah, sheer brilliance and dedication and integrity that enabled the legacy of the Chazanish to endure 66 years after his passing. The guidelines that he established still dictate how the mitzvot atulis ba'aretz are carried out. His shiurim and chumros are widely observed. They now 7 volumes, I mentioned earlier, of a set called Maasei Ish, anecdotes, mussar, advice, divrei Torah of the Chazon Ish. And the parameters that he set for Haredi interactions with the general society still determine how governments in Israel are formed and how they fall and still dominate life in the Haredi world. That is a strong personality, making the Chazon Ish one of the greatest rabbis of his era. Yehi Zichro Baruch. I thank you all very much.